And while I think there is great value in proceeding deliberately, and we certainly have thought a lot about all the good things you're supposed to think about, sustainability and scalability and how do you get buy-in and all the good strategic things, the origination really was people becoming quite interested in something that was affecting their, well, how do I put this? And see, it's so funny. When I try to talk about this, it becomes very elusive. I remember how it happened. I remember how things got rolling. It's very difficult to figure out exactly what the connection was that took it up onto a higher level or onto a wider stage. But I guess what I'm trying to say very haltingly is that what was always important for me and what I think accounts for a lot of what is going on at this particular institution is a kind of individual testimonial. That is to say, most of the stuff that we're doing comes out of individuals having very interesting experiences about things they become quite passionate about and bringing that passion into a conversation, then strategies and plans emerge for where the exploration might go or how things might ramp up a bit. But really, in just about every case I can think of, it starts from individuals becoming excited about things. Somebody discovers Flickr. Somebody discovers, you know, DivX. Somebody discovers blogging. Somebody sees somebody else doing something and says, hey, what if we did that in a little different way over here? So it's been very grassroots. But because of that, I think that we've stayed very connected to individuals becoming very passionate about things as the wellspring for our ideas. And I think that's good.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of these inspirations are kind of coming from outside, whether it's personal use or connections outside of the institution.
Yeah, I've always said that when people have compelling experiences in their own life and work, that gets the juices flowing, you know, in a larger context as well. If nobody's excited about it for anything other than institutional usage, probably they're not very excited about it for that either. And sometimes that's okay. I mean, I guess we don't have to have passionate connections to fluorescent lighting. But then even as I say that, I say, well, but if we cared more about the spaces in which we live and work, I might not have these ugly fluorescent lights right above me right now. It might be something more interesting there. So I really am a great believer in people finding something that speaks to them and then bringing that into a conversation where we can see what sorts of ramifications those individual experiences might have for larger contexts.
How would you describe sort of the, I don't know, the environment that kind of evolved at Mary Washington? Is it a lab? Is it a community? You know, what is it that sort of takes those ideas that come from some people who got a little inspired and is able, you know, to make it happen?
Well, that's an interesting question. We're in a good niche here as far as having some latitude for innovation. We're primarily a teaching college, so the emphasis on research is a little bit lower here than it's going to be in a lot of places. That means that we're likely to get faculty who are very interested in teaching. Not that they're not interested in research, but because the teaching here is rewarded, it's a major part of what our merit evaluation rests on, they're going to be interested in doing things that are going to make the teaching environment more rewarding for students and for them. So there's already a way in which the focus of the institution encourages and rewards innovation in the classroom. I think that we have a very interesting mix of students. They tend to be very bright, but they tend to want something that's a little more intimate, something that's a little more experimental. They're not at a big school like UVA, which they could have gotten into, and they're not at a school that's a really high-profile school in the same way that something like William and Mary might be. So the atmosphere is a little, I don't want to say looser, but it's a little more open here, maybe, to taking some risks. And I think when those conditions are there, and you may not even know they're there until you try to take a risk, but when those conditions are there and somebody says, well, hey, what about this? You can get more traction earlier than you might be able to get in other contexts. Now, when I say that, it worries me because it makes it sound like what happens here can't be generalized to other places. I don't think that's true at all. But I do think that we're fortunate here in having some conditions that make it a little easier for us to get going with some of this. That said, there are also, you know, there are also problems we face. We have almost no resources. We're a state school. We have a very limited endowment. We have a very heavy teaching load. There are all sorts of reasons why things shouldn't be able to work the way they do here.
The institution is doing something. I mean, you actually have, in my mind, a pretty good ratio for your, you know, instructional technology specialist to faculty. And, you know, and maybe if you could talk a little bit about your leadership there, because it certainly would like to see people with, you know, Chip's perspective in a lot of places.
Yeah. It actually goes back even before Chip. The first instructional technology director we had a vision of essentially embedding instructional design / tech support people out in the various academic buildings. So he hired, I guess, 5 instructional technology specialists back in 1996, 1997. And the institution was willing to commit those resources because it was clear that we would need to do something to ramp up faculty involvement and faculty training and so forth. And I think the idea of embedding the people in the academic departments was a very good one. And we got lucky with some of the hires. A couple of those folks who were on very early in that program are still here. I think what Chip did when he got here was take that to the next level. And it's his particular vision that has enabled the instructional technology support here to focus more on academic partnerships with faculty and less on tech support issues. That's gone over to user services, and that's a process that began actually when he first came here. And in my years as assistant vice president, that was very much the direction we wanted to go in, away from how do you, you know, can you help me put ink in my printer, which is an important service, but not the best use of the particular talents of an instructional technology specialist, and more in the direction of partnership, of being able to think hard about what's going on in particular disciplines, really much more like the way librarians think about their partnership with faculty. And that's been, as I say, a direction Chip pursued early on. He's been willing to, you know, walk the walk as well as talk the talk. Put resources there to support that. We got some terrific hiring opportunities while I was directing the group, and in the year and a half almost since I stepped down from that position, Martha Burtis, who was one of the folks, actually she was, I guess she was my first real hire start to finish here. She's very capably led the group even farther in that direction, and Chip's support has been absolutely vital for that. He has been willing to put resources in the service of real strategic gains in terms of that partnership I've been describing. And that's hard when things are on fire, right? When people's computers are breaking, it's hard to stick with that vision that we've got to be strategic about this as well. But he's done that.
Right. And I was, I'm still struck by my experience of being only there 2 days for your faculty academy. He was there for the entire 2 days. He wasn't. He didn't have his nose buried in a Palm Pilot. And in fact, he was fully engaged with the discussions activities and one of the primary photographers.
Yeah, Chip's heart is really with the academic mission of the institution, and I know that, you know, most CIOs, certainly all good CIOs, are devoted to supporting the academic mission of the institution. But I think Chip's Chip's devotion goes even a little farther than you might usually find, in that he's passionately engaged with the intellectual underpinnings of what it is we're doing. He's very, very interested in in thinking about this, really the way a faculty member would. And because of that, he's engaged in the work that's happening at Faculty Academy in just the way that you've talked about it. I mean, he's certainly attentive to the stuff that's going on back in his shop. He's got to be. But he's not real distractible that way. You know, he recognizes that when he's participating, he's learning, he's sending a message about his own involvement, and frankly, he's really interested in what's going on in the classroom. He had very deep and transformative experiences of his own when he was a student, and he is extremely committed to making sure that those experiences can happen and he can support them in his role. So, you know, he's a huge ally of what the faculty are doing.
Excellent. And I just want to sort of aim towards the end of this brief, I said, call. I've been thinking a lot about, you know, what I used to sort of call the nice technology fire hose seems to be turned up past the 11 on the volume knob. You know, it was for a while someone in our field, you could have a pretty good grasp on the things you wanted to recommend to people. There was, you know, Flickr for photos and Delicious for your bookmarks. There's almost too many tools to track these days. Any sort of thoughts on what that means for the work we do, and also for the work that faculty have to do to deal with this onslaught?
Yeah, I've got some real definite thoughts about this. You've pushed a button here in a good way. At a core level, we have got to get to a thorough, embedded curricular presence for what we could call new media studies. In essence, what you're describing is a scaling up that we can't follow in one direction. We can't keep track of every single new thing that comes out. So change the paradigm. What are the commonalities here? What are the core intellectual elements that, if we understand them, are going to make it much easier and much more interesting for us to grasp the next thing that comes down the road? Because, you know, you could say, well, blogs and wikis are completely different. But they're not really. They're different ways of organizing, managing, and presenting content. The differences matter. But if you can get at those commonalities, you're not going to be caught like a deer in the headlights the next time something new comes. You're going to be able to say, oh, that's like this, but turned 90 degrees this way. Or, no, I see these things are really getting at some of these particular foundations of thinking about information organization. And to me, it's very much what the pioneers of networked computing were working on when computers were really just coming online in any kind of major way outside of maybe two or three research institutions. They really did think that this would make us think about the way we think, about the way we communicate, about what we can automate, what we shouldn't automate. It seems to me that by engaging with questions at that level, two things will happen. First of all, when you get to the conceptual level, you're already where faculty live, so they're going to have a sense of, oh, this is about concepts. I can do this. I may be frustrated when I try to think about buttons on a mouse, but if we're dealing with concepts, I can kind of go there. Right? The second thing that will happen is once you get to that conceptual level, people will be much more comfortable switching tools, which is what they're going to have to be doing for the rest of their lives. This stuff is accelerating. It's not going to be standing still. So you really need to get at this on a level that's going to equip people to take a new thing when it comes along, understand where it's coming from, what it connects to, and give them some strategies for being able to get at it and find a way to make it useful for themselves, or even to evaluate whether it will be useful.
Wow. I'm glad I had the recorder on for that. That was awesome. And then last, and actually I will put this first, I ended up, hitting the record button, but if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself, Gardner, and then give a big, hello, Australia.
This is Gardner Campbell speaking to you from his office in the Department of English, Linguistics, and Speech at the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia. And I'd like to say a big hello to all of my friends down under. I have never been to Australia, except in my mind, and via Skype video, but I certainly hope to come down there someday.